this week. The Golden Silver Bull rally continued for the fourth week in a row, while the Dow Jones Industrials picked up 100 points, still on track for 20,000. Welcome back to Gold Seek Radio, everyone. Chris Walczak with you. We've got another hour plus of infotainment-packed interviews, plus three listeners call in to our Q&A segment. Well, investors continued to favor the precious metals for a month now, as uncertainty over the new norm in the financial markets ratchets up with the new presidential term. Bob Hoy returns with good news for the precious metals miners and those who invest in them. He's impressed with what appears to be the first impulse and reaction of a new secular bull market. Adding to their appeal, increased tensions in the EU nations could spark the next leg higher. We discuss research from Doug Casey, who reviewed the World Gold Council data and found that the Middle East is the third largest gold consumer, eclipsing even the U.S. And for the first time in modern history, the region might surpass India and even China as the top gold consumer. Beginning in March, new gold-friendly legislation could facilitate big purchases in the region without violating Sharia law. Doug Casey notes that $3 trillion might just flood into the precious metals sector as 112 Islamic billionaires gain access to our favorite safe haven asset. Then, John from San Diego and a few other callers call in. He's concerned by black swans and technical analysis. You'll want to stay tuned for the entire segment. Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear report. And we'd like for you to call into the voicemail number. We have a hotline here, 641-715-3900. Please jot the number down. Plus, you'll need our access code, 641-715-3900, with the access code 514049. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility virtually unlimited over the precious metals market for the fourth week running on a continued sell-off in the greenback. Gold picked up nearly a percentage point, $9, ending over $1,200 an ounce at $1,204. Silver added 27 cents, 1.5%, finishing over $17 an ounce at $17.03. The precious metals XAU shares added 1.6 points at 88.5. That was 2% and well above all support levels with solid technical indications. Black gold finished up nearly a dollar per barrel at $53.22, gaining 1.6% and ignoring the drop in the CRB, which still gives us that strong case for $70-plus dollar oil this year. The top story driving the precious metals this week was clearly the inauguration of the 45th President of the United States. Uncertainty is common in the first year of any new presidency, which was clearly evident over the past four-week rally in the precious metals sector. The highly controversial figure has investors prepping for chaotic market extremes, preferring the relative safety of the precious metals over the risk-on trade assets. Adding to uncertainty, the new president publicly supported a weaker greenback to encourage exports from domestic manufacturers, while the Treasury Secretary Pick, Steven Mnuchin, noted this week it will take some time for the administration to begin acting on those policies. The weak dollar stance was further corroborated by recent statements. Still, the risk of higher rates from the Fed and the EU BOJ and PBOC colleagues continues to loom over the sector. This week, Fed head Dr. Yellen made relatively hawkish comments, hinting at higher rates, but the economic analysts are forecasting still lower GDP, which might just put the brakes on those proposed rate hikes. Adding to the positive case for the precious metals, stimulative fiscal policy and public infrastructure spending under a current administration will almost certainly result in higher prices, which could also boost demand for gold and silver. Inflation will also lessen the case for more Fed rate hikes and keep real interest rates in negative territory, the ideal environment for gold bulls. Plus, inflation requires even higher debt levels to keep the government cogs well-oiled and spinning, which could send the national debt above the $20 trillion level in the coming years, boosting the case for the inevitable runaway inflation that many analysts have been looking for, and an epic gold bull run. According to Paul Wong, senior portfolio manager at Sprott Asset Management and Bloomberg.com, Precious metals, bottom line. The XAU gold ratio continues to indicate a bull market. However, the CRB did show some pretty solid weakness this week. It was really the one sector, the one chart that looked a bit bearish. As long as the XAU, though, remains red hot above all support levels, I expect further spectacular gains this year. Plus, our gold seek favorite gold company, Gold Mining INC, ticker GOLD.V, formerly Brazil Resources, put in a potential solid floor this week that could catapult shares higher, hopefully, as the XAU rally continues. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly sunny skies persisted over the New York Stock Exchange this week as a relatively peaceful change of the guard and regime change in Washington, D.C. took place on Friday. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones Industrials added 100 points, ending at 19,827 on a solid path to 20,000, which would be an all-time record high. The S&P 500 gave back only 5 points, though, ending at 2270 for the week, while the NASDAQ was off 20 points, finishing at 55.55. The so-called Trump trade has put a permanent smile on many stock bulls' faces, especially as the Dow blasted higher by 7% following the surprise election outcome. The Dow still just shy of that 20,000 milestone. However, according to UBS's Art Cashin, legendary Wall Street trader, the smart money is fading this uptrend, and over the last 100 years, nearly every time the market was sluggish near the beginning of the year, a substantial sell-off followed. Some analysts are concerned that the protectionist tone of the new administration, along with their party in control of both the House and the Senate, will lead to many new policies that will increase volatility in the markets amid the presidential honeymoon period. Friend of the show Peter Schiff had this to say about it: the new president will likely preside over the biggest expansion of the federal deficits in our history, which of course bodes very well for almost every market. Bottom line on Wall Street: the technical picture for the sector remains somewhat positive, and the fear and greed index is not giving us a reading. It's still in neutral territory. So it looks as though the market psychology has sort of entered a waiting period, and the VIX isn't telling us much either. As long as support holds, an assault on new highs is possible. But again, who am I to contradict Art Cashin? If Art Cashin says the market is risky this year, well, maybe Katie bar the doors. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with our two big guests and Robert Ian. We'd like for you to stay with us. Bob Hoy has advised institutional clients for 30 years at least as editor and chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com. It's just a pleasure to have him back with us today. How's the weather in Vancouver?
Well, we had unusually cool weather and snow for a while, but the warm weather with the rains came in the other day. I kind of call it the Maui monsoon, but there's been a lot of good snow up in the mountains for skiing. So, but as I say, Vancouver is sort of Canada's banana belt, and of late we don't get much snow in the city at all. So it was 3 or 4 weeks of unusual amounts of snow.
I'm sure the skiers are enjoying that, although I bet you all are much better prepared for heavy snowfall than we are in the Appalachian.
Oh, no, not too much Vancouver, because when it comes, it's sort of close to the freezing point, and it's slippery no matter where you live. But I think a lot of people have all-wheel drive cars, snow tires. You can get around all right that way.
Well, we've had an unseasonably warm winter here, and we're...
Oh, yeah, you had that pulse of... But around the world, it has been cool. Like in Siberia, there was 80 below Fahrenheit.
I was talking to an acquaintance from the Windy City, and we were noting how once the temperature gets below zero, it's difficult to differentiate between, you know, zero and minus 20, minus 30, minus 40, just cold.
It's bleeping cold indeed. But I think Moscow, they had a low temperature, I don't know, minus 25 Fahrenheit, and that was the coldest in over 100 years.
In 2017, the precious metals are off to a relatively solid start, up 4% or so. Do you expect these solid times to persist, or will the U.S. dollar continue in its upward trajectory?
Well, on the gold sector, because, you know, I sort of focus on the on the gold shares themselves, because when you're in a post-bubble contraction, one of the features has been that the senior currency becomes chronically firm against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time, is the way I like to put it. So I can't get excited about silver or gold being traded in U.S. dollars. You have a problem there. But Mother Nature has a way of making the gold business very profitable in a post-bubble contraction. The main thing is that the real price of gold, it firms up. So gold is firming up relative to, say, energy costs. So if you're a miner and you've got a good control on your energy costs and you're getting a decent price for gold, you're going to make money. So we look at the gold sector as an investment in gold shares. Trading gold and silver in U.S. dollars is for traders. I don't see any huge amounts of money being made on it. Well, we are in a cyclical bull market for gold shares, of which it has had the first serious and significant correction. If you recall, last summer in July, we noted all the excesses in the sector and called for a significant correction. And then in November, we're outlining it. It was almost just like November the previous year that we wanted to see the gold shares, we used the Huey, begin to outperform the bullion price, set a base, which it did, and then it broke out, and that was the blessing. It's a cyclical bull market for gold. It could run for some time, basically on improving earnings for the sector, which gets us back to looking at it as an investor. And the other thing about these post-bubble contractions, and just to put it in perspective here, Chris, this is the crash ended in 2009, and it was a classic crash because it had followed a classic bubble. Then you've had a long but weak expansion in the economy and a very long bull market in stocks. All of the excess credit that central bankers have been pushing into the markets haven't been stimulating the economy, which is their peculiar theory, but we've taken that theory apart for decades, that that's a correlation on credit expansion and the business expansion, not a causation. And so anyways, this now is getting long in the tooth, the economic expansion. But we note that, you know, it's sort of got firmer since June. So we've been calling it the positive wave, and that as part of the positive wave, you've had the Brexit referendum vote in England to separate from the authoritarian Europe. And you've had the then in November, the U.S. election, which is a move to end the authoritarian experiment that's been running in Canada or in the U.S. So this is very constructive, but and you had, like you had, even though they rigged the numbers, the GDP figure for the third quarter was good. That's to the end of September. And so things are generally pretty good. Now, what has happened is that with the Trump win, this is the most remarkable political change, I think, in American history, because you went from the most authoritarian experiment in U.S. history with the Obama administration to now a non-politician, Trump, heading up the next government in American history. So it's very dynamic times. So this has prompted like small business confidence, various things like that, to jump up to the highest since November 1980, when Reagan won that key election and then started a pro-business administration, which, of course, was fought and thwarted by Democrat Congress and a Democrat Senate. So, but on this one now, with the Republicans, as I read, are in the strongest position since the 1920s, they will be able to affect policy. The left, the authoritarians, will fight it. As we've seen already, it is nasty out there because the left just doesn't like to lose. But that then, they will eventually get tired. I think what will happen is that as the new administration moves along, the popular uprising, which really is the winner on the whole political change, it's in control. And Trump just happens to be the head of it. And it looks like he's making some pretty good executive decisions in cabinet appointments as they go through. So now the next question, Chris, is how much of this great political change and pro-business stance is in the market? Well, I think quite a bit. So we can have, I've called it rational exuberance. You recall back in 1996 when valuations were getting extremely stretched. That was December that year, wasn't it? When Greenspan, then chairman of the Fed, noted that he thought this was irrational exuberance. Well, that was 96, and that bull market went on to 2000. But because of the constructive pro-business change, we thought that moving up on it really is rational exuberance, and it is exuberance. So on some key sectors, we've got our upside exhaustions, which is readings, which relates to momentum. We've got that in the banks, and we had it in the transports. And then the other backup we've got on that is another model, which we call the sequential. And it's been giving sequential sells, and that's at the pattern. So you got two things saying it's a very good top. That was momentum related and pattern related. So we're looking now for a rounded top in the stock, in the big stock market. It could take a number of months. Now, when to go back to your question about gold, in previous post-bubble contractions, as I've said, the gold sector does very well, and it does opposite to what's going on in the ordinary sector. And so there has been a little opposite here going on, and it's constructive. So we like the gold stocks, and you realize, of course, there will be some swings in them. They also could be vulnerable to when the first serious downdraft in the big stock market comes in. But again, as I said, Chris, we like the gold stocks.
Very good. Well, I'd like to discuss interesting development that Doug Casey brought up after researching the World Gold Council recently. I found this rather surprising. Now, we all know that China, number one gold importer and producer, for that matter, so number one consumer. India just nipping at its heels and, for the longest time, the number one consumer of gold, of the yellow metal. But another key region, not an individual nation, the next most ravenous consumer of the precious metals, and that is the Middle East, because of the Islamic laws against trading in certain types of commodities, which gold, incidentally, is included within. Because it is a major consumer, there is some interesting aspects to the story that Doug Casey brought up recently. Due to certain Sharia law issues and other legalities, gold is very difficult to trade in the Middle East. In many, many areas, it's virtually impossible for even institutions to procure the metal in any size or build a position. Well, all of that, according to Doug Casey's research, will change in this March. The World Gold Council and, I want to say, another key organization are working with the Islamic interests to make it remarkably simple for anyone to procure gold without breaking any of the Sharia laws or any of the Muslim traditions. And this supposedly will open up, you might say, the floodgates of at least $3 trillion. Now, he thinks that could occur immediately. I would propose that it might take a bit longer than by April of this year that we'll see $3 trillion flood in. But here's some interesting metrics. There are currently 112 billionaires in that region. Many folks know there is a long history and tradition penchant for the yellow metal in the Middle East. If you look at the bigger picture here, considerably more gold pours into the Middle East than the United States. It is entirely possible that the Middle East as a region might even eclipse, you know, the rousing tiger nation as well as India in gold consumption in the years to come. Do you care to give us your outlook on Doug Casey's work and perhaps some of the minutia of this developing story?
Sure. I got my start as an independent researcher in 1976, gosh, Chris, that's a while ago, with a couple of the big mining firms in Vancouver taking on our research, or at that time it was my research, on a retainer basis. I learned a lot about mining companies and supply and demand and all that sort of stuff, and the main thing I learned was that nobody can do supply and demand analysis on any metal. It's a great frustration and is best avoided. So where I was able to get the start with these big mining companies was because I could provide them with a method of anticipating price changes in metal prices. And that's what it's really all about. So they were trying to do it with analyzing supply and demand, which is never accurate. It's always a way behind the market prices, and I've just found it, well, sometimes amusing, but most of the time I just try and avoid it and also try to explain to people that it just doesn't work. You want to go back, Doug Casey may be very good at it, but the guy that was the best and the most thorough and the most intensive, and it didn't work. He did not catch the bear market in gold after 2011. He thought he had every ounce of gold nailed down and that there was some sort of massive shortage. But it's an accounting thing. It's not a market thing. And it's very dangerous to go from supply demand to try and figure out what the price is going to do. So there's my thought. I've met with him at a number of the mining forums and stuff, and he's a fun guy. He's a really good guy. But forget about supply demand on any metal.
There was an interesting article, Why Silver Could Advance Sharply in 2017. Several topics that are brought up here, including the incumbent president, the change of the guard, if you will, or regime change in the White House. Apparently, this author is convinced that inflation could become a much more compelling story. The Brexit and other imminent exits from the EU, including, let's say, Italy, potentially France. Few folks are talking about, but it looks as though its days in the Eurozone could be limited as well. I'd like your thoughts on these two issues, as whether or not the new administration and the threat of more exits from the EU could boost the demand for the safe haven metals.
First of all, you mentioned inflation. I assume you mean CPI inflation. Don't see anything going out of control there. This business expansion is getting mature somewhere. It could weaken. I don't see CPI inflation as a problem. And you're in a strange world when you got the Federal Reserve, which spent all through the 1970s and 80s saying that inflation was not a problem. And then when it did become a problem, they weren't part of the problem. And now they're trying to get inflation up to 2%, and perhaps they're getting there, but I don't expect it to last. It's not as if there's any shortages of goods and services out there. And we should recall that Friedman said that forever inflation is a monetary thing, but he didn't get into the concept of inflation in financial assets. And this is what we have had. You've had the biggest bond bubble in history. There's never been anything like it, where in one particular country, Germany, you got rates down to effectively zero, then you got near-term maturities trading at a minus rate. This has been where the huge inflation has been in. It's been inflation in bond prices. And without that inflation in bond prices, the Fed and other central bankers wouldn't have been able to get the credit out. And this is one of the things I wrote a piece a few years ago called Inflation is Instantaneous. So the gold bugs think that when the Fed is being irresponsible, that the and it's not inflation now, inflation will happen later on. But when the Fed needs speculation in some kind of an asset in order to be reckless, and the speculation has been in bonds. It hasn't been in gold and silver, not since the big blow-off in those items in 2011. So what one should be concerned about is a liquidity problem in the global bond market, which, by the way, using the U.S. long-dated treasuries, it did a very dramatic and highly technical blow-off last July, and from which, you know, bond prices have sold off. But this is just early stuff. So, yeah, the idea of now worrying about CPI inflation is not a worry. One should be very concerned about where the inflation has been, which has been in the bond market. And as it starts to come down, and if it really begets a liquidity problem, it's going to kill everything out there. And again, what will happen is that in a deflation, gold's real price traditionally has gone up. Then that makes the gold mining business one of the premier industries in a world of weak prices for most businesses and industry and that sort of thing. So, Chris, what we're looking at here is some convictions on the part of critics of central banking that have been in the street as long as I've been, since the 1960s. I guess Dines was the first one to come out and start talking about inflation and all that sort of stuff. And now the whole of the world realizes that there is such a thing as CPI inflation. But the important thing is that CPI inflation hasn't been a problem since 1981, when the CPI rate of inflation peaked at, 14 or 15%. The long bond went to trading at 15% yield, and now it's got down to, almost 2%. This is where the action's been. So the danger is not CPI inflation. That will not drive gold prices up. The danger is a collapsing bond market, and which was the big action of, since 2011, when base metals and precious metals headed south. So again, the phrase I've used has been inflation is instantaneous, and it's whatever the action is on the big game, and the big game has bonds, and the big game bonds is coming apart. So there's where the big deflation will be in bond prices.
The Fed has the magic pen. They have carte blanche authority to create as much additional debt as possible, where they could, you know, step in, continue to absorb their own toxic debt, the Treasury market. Nevertheless, eventually, we all know the music has to stop.
Just a minute. I'm going to back up a bit on this, Chris, because this is an elusive concept. The rising bond prices permitted the Fed to be reckless. In the 1970s, rising commodity prices and wage prices permitted the Fed to be reckless. So, and then when the commodities started to crash in 1981, that then set up the world of financial asset inflation, just the same as when commodities soared in 1920, crashed in 1921, the Federal Reserve then was easy on the money markets because they were afraid of commodities going down further. That was through the 1920s. But they didn't understand that the credit would eventually go into the financial markets, where then you had the 1929 bubble. So same thing this time. Commodities blew out in 1980, 81. Then the action shifted over, where you had The Fed under Volcker did not tighten at all. If you take a look at money supply figures, they continued to grow, but you had a crash in commodities and the start of inflation in financial assets, of which the game has been, the big game has been in the global bond markets, and that's ending action. So when the bond prices come down, the Fed will not be permitted to be reckless anymore. So it's, you have to really dwell on cause and effect. The Fed ease did not cause commodities to speculate in the 1970s and 80s. That was speculation in commodities allowed the Fed to expand credit. And the same thing of recent, where the bubble in financial assets has allowed the Fed to be reckless. So keep in mind that an old saying I've had is that the Fed cannot depreciate the dollar at will. Most gold bugs think that it can. But, hey, the dollar's been going up since 2009. Also, that is one of the features of a post-bubble contraction is a firming senior currency, which we're getting. And it's had a correction here the last week, but it's getting prepared to make another major move up.
Well, let's move on to another interesting gold pundit, of course, Jim Rickards. An outspoken proponent of the yellow metal in recent years, calling for a minimum of 10% allocation into one's portfolio of gold and silver investments, anticipating a cash ban. You might think of it as a banking holiday, sort of echoing what's occurring right now in Modi's India. We might eventually find the ATM, Bob, is empty.
Oh, yeah, I know the gold guys have gone wild over what's happened in England, India. That's an atrocity what their government is doing. But in the U.S. now, the change is going to be away from, they're going to audit the Fed. They're going to watch this thing, and also the Fed is going to be seen not to work. So now, Rickard, I see his stuff, and he always prompts my curiosity, because I remember something in the summer. There was some great event was going to happen late in September, and subscribers would be advised. And, I don't remember anything special coming out. And then again, the date for something great that he knows the secret of is going to come out in December. I don't know. I should keep a little blotter on those statements about sensational things happening and then not happening.
Another interesting topic that we've seen in the headlines recently, shares in companies, i.e. stock shares, simply are no longer the predominant investment vehicle traded on their specific exchange. In other words, ETFs, exchange-traded funds, which you might think of as an actively traded mutual fund, where one can buy shares in virtually any index that you could imagine being thrown together. GBTC, I believe, is the ticker of the Bitcoin ETF, which, of course, is run by the Winklevoss twins, are now famous or infamous, illustrated in the movie regarding Facebook. Nevertheless, the point simply is here that we have too many exchange-traded funds, or maybe it's not way too many. Maybe this is the future. Maybe this is the way to invest.
Oh, yeah. Every bull market in equities creates instruments. And even the South Sea bubble in 1720, they were right off the bat with creating option things. And then if the first financial market letter writer was a guy by the name of Houghton in London in the 1690s. And he's talking about options, puts, and they don't call them puts and calls then, they call them puts and refusals. And he talks about all this trading on that was wild, and he even has one delightful paper called The Mystery of Buying More Than All, where there was only so many options issued on a company, and the street had bought more than existed, so there was a huge short squeeze there. So option strategies, ETFs, all of these time bargain things, they've been around since modern financial history began in the 1690s. So they are a feature of a highly speculative period.
all of the early bubbles, I think, were punctuated by these peculiar instruments. I seem to recall reading during the Tulip Mania in Amsterdam and around Holland, the original idea of the futures contract came into play, because as I'm sure listeners know, the tulips did not breed true, just like in the IPO mania days of the late 1990s, where people were fascinated by internet companies. Which one will become Netflix, will become Amazon, will become Google? Yeah, the next Netscape. In similar fashion, the variegated, highly desirable one could come from virtually any bulb. So there was a great speculative frenzy. And of course, very peculiar types of instruments would crop up, sort of mirroring the ETFs here. So in your opinion then, Bob, this remarkable stock market rally, which has, I guess, catapulted the Dow in the neighborhood of 20,000, and the NASDAQ, I'm sure, has either eclipsed or has come close to eclipsing its year 2000 bubble peak. Is this going to lead us to, remember, the fabled 24,000 Dow target, or is this the ultimate zenith for the market?
Yeah, good question, Chris. But those targets, wasn't one of them 35,000 Dow? And whoever was using a compound growth rate of 6% or something like that. It wasn't. On the overall stock market, we have a couple of tools we use. One relates to momentum. And at market peaks, you get a number of what we call upside exhaustions. And this is what we have been getting on this rally in the S&P, or in the bank stocks, in the transport. So that shows a high degree of speculation and momentum. The other one we use is pattern, and we call that, in this case, a sequential sell. And in those things I mentioned, we've got sequential sells as well. So the greatest change in political history to a pro-business government is, for the moment, in the market. And it's going to take some while to implement a pro-business government, and also to, hey, here's a new word, de-implement a lot of the arbitrary intrusive stuff that the authoritarians have been using. So it is good times, but also, like, there was some small business index enthusiasm is the highest it's been since November 1980 when Reagan won, and that was a pro-business situation. So a lot of the good stuff forthcoming is in the market, and I think the safest thing to say, we could have a correction from here. As a matter of fact, since we've been talking, the Dow has gone from down 40 to down 100. So a correction, but it would be within, let's call it a rounded top, where maybe crude oil being reasonably good out to March is a possible. Maybe credit spreads haven't changed yet. So what we're looking for is speculative high now, or a few weeks ago, actually, something positive to keep it together on the right-hand shoulder side of a rounding top pattern. So this is what we used in 2015, was a rounding top pattern, and it turned out to work quite well. Now, also in 2015, you had a speculative blow-off in Shanghai market, and on our work then, we needed the third upside exhaustion reading, and we got that in June. So that call was straightforward. Now, the rebound in Shanghai has not been nearly as dramatic, but it is giving some, it gave us some breathing. You could say it's way overbought, so there's a probability. Yield curve has started to turn. Credit spreads are not yet started to turn. So let's call the stock market precarious.
Bring in one last piece to this puzzle as we wrap up. I think overlooked somewhat the importance to the mutual fund flows into the equities market. that keep sending shares higher that aren't coming from, let's say, the EU, you know, or both sides of the ponds, if you will, Japan, Asia, and the EU fleeing those regions. But here domestically, at least on paper, it appears that the bulk of those funds flowing in come from the biweekly or monthly paycheck automatically sent over into pension funds and related mutual funds that then have to remain invested in this sector, the only sector that's really producing anything right now of interest to the typical investor. But what happens when the economy starts to turn around and incomes begin to shrivel up? You know, without that constant or at least continuous flow of funds and investment capital, will we be able to sustain, you know, this 8-9 year bull market in equities? Or will folks start to look around for more solid investments like the safe havens?
It's price that determines a bull or bear market, and the flows follow. So again, we just look at the action in the big market has become toppy, but there are events in credit spreads, for example, that have yet to happen. The reversal in the yield curve is already a warning on the bank stocks. So things are coming into place for a top.
The only thing I'd add in here as we close is that, you take a look at the Dow, the S&P, the major U.S. equities indexes from, let's say, late 2014 all the way through 2015 and 2016, there was every chance that the peak was in place. Just like old turkey from reminiscences, shares keep making new highs. And, you know, as long as an index continues making new highs and relatively higher lows, we can see this market run many years longer than most of the bears can remain solvent.
We're not calling for a peak of the bull market now. We're looking for another rounded top. At some point, the credit excesses will become, hey, when's the settlement date, or immense. At some point, you go into a cyclical credit contraction. But all we can do now on the stock market is to say that it looks like it's building a rounded top and let it work out over the next number of months. But listen, I'll add one more little thing to your bit about the tulip mania in Holland, which was the commercial and financial center of the world. Now, when they started trading the tulip bulbs, these were by non-professionals. They were, let's call them as we used to, odd lotters. They were trading them in taverns. Now, the authorities, I guess, in Amsterdam said and uttered warnings that these were unenforceable contracts outside of the financial system, whereas inside they had a clearing means where then contracts were enforceable. But they were very clear to say that the tulips were unenforceable contracts and watch out. And then it went.
Those who don't learn the lessons of history, doomed to repeat it. We're looking forward to plenty of comments and commentary and insightful historical tidbits in 2017. Please tell people more about Institutional Advisors.
Yeah, you can get in touch with us. We got the website, institutionaladvisors.com, or you can just Google my name, Bob Hoy, H-O-Y-E, and it all comes up. And you can get into the website, see our history, see the methods that we use, and take a subscription.
Sounds great. Bob Hoy, we appreciate your thoughts. Talk soon.
Very good, Chris. Next time.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Opening up the digital mailbag for listeners Q&A. First up, longtime listener John in sunny California.
Hi, Chris. John here, formerly of Downers Grove, Illinois, now living in usually sunny San Diego, but we've had more rain in the last 2 weeks than we have in the last 2 years. Anyway, I digress. About Bob Hoy, I certainly appreciate his encyclopedic knowledge of financial history. He certainly seems to be a crackerjack technician, and he's not unwilling just to speak the truth as he sees it, regardless. But here's the flaw in technical analysis today. The markets are extremely manipulated, so technical analysis, you might as well just throw it out the window. And number two, technicians cannot see or account for black swan events. There is no way for them to do this. And God knows we have many black swans flying around right now that are about to land. Let's give Lehman Brothers the once over. What technician foresaw the Lehman Brothers debacle? None. Of course, Lehman was the scapegoat. The Fed surely knew that if they didn't intervene to bail Lehman Brothers out and they let Lehman collapse, that probably was going to trigger a financial collapse in general, which it certainly did, or at least it was blamed on the Lehman Brothers debacle. In any event, what happens when the bond market, the 10-year, suddenly punches through 3% and goes up to 3.5% or 4%? That's my question. I think blood will be running in the streets, quite frankly. I think that J.P. Morgan, also one of their analysts, also said the same thing recently. So I think that we might have a big run-up in the precious metals here if something like that happened. Totally unforeseen by technicians like Hoy, but with all due respect. Anyway, your thoughts? Keep up the good work. Love the show.
Hi, John. You know, I think you make some fantastic points. You know, we have to tip our hats right to Bob Hoy. I mean, obviously, his wealth of knowledge, total recall of virtually everything he's ever read. And of course, then his technical work is spot on as well most of the time. Nevertheless, I'd like to focus more in the direction of technical analysis, which you evidently are not a huge fan, as well as your concept of black swans. Let's do bring up Lehman Brothers as well as Bear Stearns. In WALTSEC 2010, Wealth Building Strategies, as well as my dissertation, 150-page dissertation, which was published on ProQuest 2016, Enhanced Modern Portfolio Theory via Long Memory Regimes. There's a title for you. Oh, pedantic PhDs. Point out, using Bayesian analysis, that there is a
unbelievable tendency for downtrends and collapses and crises to unfold amid regime changes, which we'll just refer here as a negative trend or a downward trend. And so this is really a truism found throughout all data series, not just in the financial markets. And we find it with earthquakes, volcano eruptions, heart arrhythmias, EKGs, epileptic seizures. Electrical engineers will recognize the patterns unfold identical to financial markets. You see head and shoulders patterns, bottoms top, and you also see trends and themes. In, you know, both of my books, I guess if you'll call them, I point out that Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns were telegraphing months in advance there was a serious potential problem. And not only that, but the markets themselves saw a big problem months, even a year in advance before the big collapse we saw in 2008, 2009. So, I mean, I would argue that black swans, regardless of how manipulated the markets are always evidenced in the markets themselves, with maybe one proviso, because I know we're splitting hairs here, and you obviously have done your homework, and you know with an individual security, there are times with, you know, gaps up, gaps down, earnings announcements, or they're cooking the books. In that situation, sure, it's too late to really know. But you have to keep in mind that even though Lehman Brothers wasn't apparent to the overwhelming majority of us, and maybe even all the analysts, there was always that one bookworm, the Coke bottle-sized glasses, who was aware of it and was advising his friends, family, co-workers, and his own broker to sell those shares. And that's where we start to see signs, because suddenly the smartest money, we'll call it, says, you know, these books don't look quite right. Something doesn't add up here. The equation is not balanced. Okay, so we need to start hedging, or either hedging our position or looking for short positions against this market or this security. And we saw that months in advance. But you are right that black swans are difficult, if not impossible, to predict. But I would still argue that you'll see signs in the charts. Someone got a whiff of it in advance. Somebody anticipated it over 99% of the time. Regardless, it's cuisine for cogitation, and we always appreciate your thoughts. Please call in more often. All right, moving on to the next caller.
Hi, Chris. Calling here from San Francisco, listening to your show right now. Been listening to it since you guys have been doing this. And, you know, I've never called. I just wanted to call and say thanks, man. I enjoy listening to your voice. I enjoy, you know, coming to the office on Mondays, running the show while I take care of my Monday responsibilities and duties here in the office, and, you know, keeping tuned in, man. You're a smart guy. You got a lot going on, and I appreciate you sharing your wisdom with me and everybody else who listens to you. You know, you do a good job, and keep it up. That's all I wanted to say. Good vibes from San Francisco. Take care.
Well, thanks, caller. You know, we appreciate those kudos. And just by clicking our links and signing up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter, you know, you help support this show. Visiting GoldSeek, bookmarking GoldSeek, and telling people about the show, as well as GoldSeek, SilverSeek, and all of our brother and sister websites here. It really does a lot to keep us on the airwaves, you know, get through our 12th year here consecutively. So if you like us, consider supporting us. You know, it really is just a fractional cost, a monthly subscription, an annual subscription, and or you can always add to Bitcoin. We have that donation, and that's actually a great introduction to the next caller who says the Bitcoin address is incorrect.
Hey, Chris, just a heads up that the Bitcoin receiving address on your homepage is not a valid Bitcoin address. That's all. Bye.
Well, you know, caller, I appreciate your call. You know, this, I know this address is working just fine. My blockchain is working great, and there's currently a small sum in there. I don't know, like a quarter of a Bitcoin or something. At any rate, I think what you might be running into is when you copy and paste the address or click the address, there will be some extra code in there. And you just want to pull off that code, the mail-to code that's in there. I could clean that up. Maybe I'll do that today. Okay, that wraps up today's quick Q&A session. And if you'd like to call in with your questions and comments, you can do so at our toll-free number. You'll find it online. And I offer it at the beginning of virtually every new show, so you can jot down the number and our address mailbox number that you'll need to call in. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek Radio. The Gold gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, returning to the show, the silver investor, David Morgan, our featured guest today, he pens the Morgan Report, which can be found at themorganreport.com. Welcome back, David Morgan.
Chris, great to be with you.
Start off our discussion today. Interesting story directly from a major silver mining CEO, one whom we've had on the show, has been a big supporter of GoldSeek for some time. This individual, after more than a decade of running a top not silver company, was approached by electronics maker First Majestic Silver Corp. This would be normal, I guess, if it was regular business, if it was a regular business practice. But the major Japanese electronics maker couldn't find, you know, enough silver stockpile, enough silver supply. This is the first time this has happened, as I mentioned, in about 13 years of business by Keith Neumeyer, that, of course, the CEO's name.
First of all, this is not the first time it's happened. There's an offtake agreement with Avino Silver, which is one of the companies that we had in the Morgan Report early on, and it's been a real stellar performer. And I own that stock. And also First Majestic I've owned for years. In fact, First Majestic was on our list at like $4 a share. We watched it go up to 24. We followed up with our stop losses outlined in how to use the Morgan Report. And then, it's come back and actually traded under that, which is hard to believe with all that's happened from, way back when we first recommended the company. But regardless, I would say it's slightly different than you outlined it. First of all, I would say that this electronics firm is looking ahead to where there could be further tightness in supply, and they want a direct source. But it's not indicative of a tight supply at the present time. So in other words, these are people with vision. These are people that realize that in the future, there could be both demand on the silver supply, which means you have both industrial and investment demand. Basically, the industrial offtake is roughly 50% of the market. It's slightly more than that. It used to be about 35% of the market, and the market's growing. However, in all fairness, the industrial demand side of the equation has been flat, really, for quite a while now. Could it increase, as Keith outlined? I would say absolutely. Will it increase to, some point where industrial demand is greater than the total mining and recycling supply? I'd say absolutely not. Price is a mitigator of anything that's wanted. So a lot of uneconomic silver projects right now at, sub $20 silver become very economic at $30 silver. So that means more supply is sitting there in the ground. So, you know, to say, where is peak silver? We outlined that in the book, The Silver Manifesto, and went through our numbers and the reasons and the whys and the wherefores. And if you look at that and really study it, it's something that you could read once. And if you're really good, you might get it all. And, you know, personally speaking, it's something that if I were to see that book, didn't write it, I would have to read it a couple times to really let it all filter in. But the point, I think, is this. These companies that have vision realize that in the future that the silver supply will continue to tighten on both sides, the industrial demand side, and because of that fact, or at least in their belief, they're willing to negotiate something. But I just want to be, for the record, clear that that actually took place a couple years prior with Avino, Avino Silver and Gold, and now, of course, First Majestic is an NYSE stock run by one of the top CEOs, as you well know, Keith Neumeyer, as you named. And also, you know, because it's an NYSE stock, it carries a lot more clout than, let's say, Avino Silver might at this time. By the way, I do own First Majestic, if I didn't mention that.
That's a really interesting overview, and it's a little different from what we're hearing in the blogosphere today. Do you suspect other companies are being approached, similar offers made, or is this just an anomaly?
Well, actually, if you dig deep enough, what you'll find is those type of agreements are done and have been done for quite some time through a third party. So if you really look at what's called the book or what the over-the-counter agreements are with the people that produce it, which are the miners, and the people that use it on an absolutely required basis, which are the industrial users, what you'll find is that there is an intermediary that actually has a direct line with, let's say, the smelter or the refiner to take that silver and pipe it directly to the end user. So it's not a big shock. What is different is that the third party's been removed, and rather than go through a quote-unquote broker, they're doing it direct, which I think is smart on the part of the company, although it becomes more transparent. So it's obvious that, you know, the public wakes up and say, oh, this electronics firm, this conglomerate, this, you know, large corp is buying silver direct from a major producer like First Majestic. What does that mean? And what it means to me is that they're making sure that there is no third-party interference. Now, that's my opinion. And you know, Chris, I try to state the facts as much as I possibly can, but people pay us for our opinions, our, you know, ability to forecast the future, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I'm happy to see it. It does, to me, indicate what I've said since basically the beginning of the year. Silver and gold are trading differently than they have in a long time.
Almost 4 or 5 years of a downtrend, lower lows, lower highs, and now we finally see some excitement come back into the market. So certainly the underlying trend is starting to change. Do you suspect that this is a long-term theme, though? Could we just back and fill a number of years as we saw the S&P 500 do, as we saw the HGX housing market following its crash? Yeah, a lot of times, bear markets require 2 or 3 years to sort out.
Well, great question, and thanks for pointing that out. First of all, I will say I don't know. I mean, anyone that's really, you know, going to be honest is going to tell you that. Now, there'll be people that use, you know, computer software, and, you know, I have some. I have plenty of it, actually. But regardless, the market knows more than anybody. My take at this point is we've gotten a little bit overexcited with this first 4 months of the new year. We do have to back and fill into that space, which will probably take us through the summer doldrums. And I'm expecting a pretty strong finish to the end of the year, which is usually the seasonality of the gold and silver market. But it has not been for the last many years where we've gotten the lowest print of the year on the last trading day of the year. So I'm well aware of that, and I'll just watch the market closely to make sure that, you know, it's going to tell me which way it's going to go. And that's how I operate, and that's what I do for the premium subscribers, is I show them exactly how the market should be interpreted based on the methodology that I've used. So coming back on point, my work shows we can't go that far. Why not? Well, because there's too much pressure on the investment demand side because of what's going on in the global empire. The empire is breaking down. Major parties are admitting that, and even using the word collapse, you've got the bond king, Bill Gross. You've got Abe saying that, you know, things are looking shaky. Maybe there's going to be, you know, global problems, I'll put it softly. And so more and more are pretty much sticking their neck out because they don't want to be in a position politically where they say, well, you never said it, or you said the opposite. You know, they don't want to say something to the effect that, you know, this conspiracy theory doesn't mean anything, and that type of thing. Well-known political figure, you know, you're peddling fiction by saying the economy isn't strong, wonderful, everything's great, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm very happy to see the position that we're in. We got a nice, strong start. We got good volume. Now we're back in fill. And I think, again, that we're going to probably be up and away, not majorly. As you well know, Chris, you do technical work as well. Unless, you know, there's a huge black swan, which is obviously out there. There's so many of them, in fact. Nonetheless, without that type of an event, it will have to work through certain levels. But it will do that on the way up pretty rapidly. And then we'll get into that parabolic move that we already witnessed in 2011 in the first quarter, and we'll see it again, except this time it's going to make that move look like a, you know, warm up.
You know, I think it's a great point. And if we take a look at just the XAU, which from, you know, the nadir of the trough there to its recent peak or zenith, we saw at least a 100% move, still holding on to the better portion of that advance. But, you know, the underlying bullion, gold and silver, has not performed, although it's been spectacular. We haven't seen that 100% move yet. It's obviously not as leveraged as the shares. I guess what I'm getting at is for the naysayers out there who don't think the metals, you know, silver can run back to 30, that would represent approximately, you know, a 100% advance from the lows or close to it.
Well, absolutely. It's one of the prime indicators that I look at. It has to be on volume. In other words, it can't be like it's got to be where the big money's coming in, and it is. And that's confirmation that we're back to the bull market. Sure, we may touch or kiss the launch point, which is what I expect. And we could go lower. We could test the old lows, whatever it was. I forget the exact numbers. Like, I know we traded a touch under 14 on silver, and I think we touched 1059 or something in that range on gold. We could hit those levels again. I really, really doubt it. But the stocks are telling us and screaming at us and, you know, ringing the bell at the bottom that the bottom is in. So the way to really make money in this market is to buy your physical bullion position and then get into the paper. And I know that I'm anti-paper and I don't want to confuse anybody, but what I just said, I'll repeat. Once you have established a physical, you can touch it position, the way to beat the bankers, the way to make a lot of fiat and then turn it into physical is to go into the paper markets. And there's no better way than to outline what we do, which is top-tier, mid-tier, and speculative companies, well-diversified, and watch these things go from 35 cents to 12 bucks, like I did on a Molly company, for an example. Look at Silver Standard. We had that 65 cents Canadian. I think that went to $40. We got out at 21. Hecla Mining, we got in at 50 cents. It got out at $5. A TED bag on an NYSE stock. We did good on Hecla Mining before anybody even knew our name or what the Morgan Report was about. And that was the same exact performance, a 10-bagger on an NYSE stock when it was the top-performing stock in the entire stock exchange in 1979. Everybody knew Hecla Mining in 1979 because of the Hunt brothers and what silver did in that 1 year, going from $6 to $50. I think we're going to see that again, Chris. In fact, I think we're going to see something even better than that just next time because it's a global empire that's being destroyed, which means all currencies will be seeking gold and silver. Once that happens, there's really no limit. Now, I'm being a bit, I don't want to be hypey, but I'm being accurate in a way because in the reality of the situation, there is a denominator of zero. There is no upside in a paper price. That's in theory. Do all paper currencies fail to absolute zero? No, they do not. There will be an intervention. There will be a reset. There'll be a new Bretton Woods. There'll be the SDR that proposed. I mean, there'll be a lot of things that will be on the table that could take place. All no cash, all electronic form. I mean, there's a lot out there that we all know about. We're all looking toward, and everyone's asking the same question, what is the next step going to look like? And the answer is really, I don't know, and very few know, and even the powers that be may not know exactly because there's infighting at the top of the pyramid.
Still a lot of negativity by those outside of the precious metals crowd. The advance this year, I mean, the hottest commodities around, although we all know they're much more than just commodities. That's the way they view this. They view them as hyperactive commodities that were oversold, and there's been some short covering, maybe a short squeeze, if you will, at the bottom. Here's the problem, I think, with their thesis. Take a look at the last time we had a peak, right, in around 1979, 1980. The underlying economics supported a peak. I mean, we had runaway inflation that was then capped with incredibly high real interest rates, which was fomented by the Federal Reserve. Right now, we have just the opposite. You remember Barsky and Summers' seminal paper, where they outline one of the most important essential ingredients for a gold and silver rally? Is negative real rates of return. Fed maybe will get one more quarter point rate hike this year. It's looking maybe July of this year. Give us your thoughts on the economics behind a potential explosive rally in the precious metals, please.
Well, I mean, I've been saying for quite some time, and especially in the, you know, lectures that I do throughout various areas, you know, Sweden, I just came back from, and you know, Canada, wherever I'm asked. But regardless, the biggest leg up is yet to take place. I believe it's in our future. I believe the time frame is probably 2017-18 in that range. I don't think it's 5 years out. I think it's more like 3 years out. I think it'll go into the financial record books, and it's going to be based on fear more than greed. It'll be because there's the perception, and perception is reality in most cases, which means that the public will come into the market to preserve whatever capital they have, and they'll come into the gold market in a very big way. But when gold gets to the point of affordability for the average person that has some savings, they'll move into the silver market. And since the silver market is a much smaller market than the gold market, you'll see something similar to what we saw in the 1980 peak that you referred to. Gold from January to January basically went from like the 300 to the 850 level, or silver went again from 6 to 50. So you had like a triple versus an eight bagger. And this is what I expect to happen again, except this time the numbers could be even larger, and it could be, you know, off. I mean, I, you know, never said I had an absolute perfect crystal ball, but I'm, you know, studied monetary history for a very long time. And we've looked at what these banks are doing to resolve the problem. And the main problem about the problem is that the problem is not even addressed. And I know I said problem three words. I used alliteration to make this point. Until you can, one, address the problem, you're not going to solve it. And it's a debt problem. And they're trying to solve it with more debt. I mean, how preposterous is that? And these are the so-called leaders. These are people that are actually exempt from leadership roles, as Alan Greenspan so eloquently pointed out, that basically the Federal Reserve is a private corp owned mostly by Europeans, I added that, that doesn't have to answer to anybody. And, of course, there is a very big tie to the federal government. I don't want to discount that too much, but in theory, they don't have to answer anybody. And they've done things that have been, let's say, surprises to the market from time to time. But they are not all powerful, although many people think they are. They are not. The market's more powerful than even the Fed. So what I'm saying is that look out for what's happening ahead. It's going to be more volatile. And people, as the trust breaks down, as the confidence breaks down, people go to where they trust and have the most confidence. And that is absolutely 100% physical paper. People will go to cash. And now if cash is outlawed, that will speed the movement into the top of the pyramid, which is the precious metal. So I see a big run to cash. I see a big run to the U.S. dollar, and that's going to get a lot of gold bugs upset. Why isn't gold going up? But it's a step in the process of the breakdown crisis. So step in the process is you're going to see a run to cash. You're going to see a run to dollar. You're going to see the dollar being like the king again. And then you're going to say, where do we go now? And when that psychology takes place and that takes hold, there's nothing that can undo it. There's no fever like gold fever. And once that psychology breaks, look out. The run to gold will be unprecedented.
And I think the key here will be, you know, a lot of people are turning to Bitcoin and alternatives like that, thinking that it will be a safe haven. I think they might be missing out on some of the limitations there to transport. Of course, you have the electronic convenience there of Bitcoin. But at the same time, I think there's always going to be some big question marks on who owns what. I mean, for instance, we had a Bitcoin major dealer and marketplace sued to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars because they, you know, had a minor glitch and lost an enormous amount, something like a quarter of a billion dollars worth of bitcoins just evaporated in midair. Well, gold has a tendency not to evaporate, and so does silver. Isn't it interesting that we read story after story on the mainline media that cash is being decimated around the world? I mean, we see government after government policymakers doing everything they can globally to eliminate reliance on basic hard currency. The whole push is towards debit cards, electronic transactions. Big Brother wants to have its fingers in the pie. It wants to know every single tax dollar you can extract much more readily. You might hear all kinds of arguments saying, well, it discourages money laundering and illegal transactions, but in reality, it limits freedom. And maybe that's a topic for another discussion. What I was really driving towards here was your point of this mad dash to cash, let's call it. I suspect that most people will be disappointed by hard cash, and I think you do as well. Let's start off with Bitcoin and electronic alternatives. How much of a threat is this to bullion?
Well, that's a great question. The answer, I really don't know. If you want my take on it, you can Google David Morgan, My Two Bits About Bitcoin, I think was the title of the article. I'm free market, and you know I can't be a hypocrite, although I'm sure there's those that may think so, but I do my best to be consistent. And so if the free market says Bitcoin's the way to go, who am I? I'm just some guy here that's, you know, an advocate of honesty and, you know a lot of things, but honest money, you know, correctness in the political system, in the financial system. Of course, it'd be nice in the political system as well. Regardless, I'm not a big fan of Bitcoin, but I'm not against it either. I think it's an alternative, and I think a lot of the gold-silver community have moved into it. I have no problem with that. What my concerns are is the same as yours. I think unless you have the best base of your foundational savings program, which is physical gold and silver, then going into Bitcoin, I think, would be fine. If you were electronic dependent only, think about it for a minute. It goes back to what you said about Big Brother. You are an electronic format. That means you have to be tied to the internet. It also means, depending on who you want to look at, but you can use the NSA as an example, you know, how secure is it really as far as the prying eyes are concerned? The last thing is basically the research I've done, it was done, and I'll give a shout-out to Charles Savoy, who's not very well-known, sent me his research, and he's one of the best. And I'm so proud to say that he contacted me so very early on when I started the website. The CIA was basically the first ones to put out a white paper looking for an all-electronic alternative, I'll call it, quote-unquote, banking system. That wasn't the words used in their paper. So you have to, you know, look really deep and down the rabbit hole, and I'm not seeing anything that I know for a fact, but you could make an argument that the beginning of the electronic alternative currencies outside the banking system may have been something that was forecast or anticipated by the powers that be. And I'm not saying I can prove that, but it is interesting that I can show you, and I'm not going to put it in the public domain, it'd be something private, what was out there in this white paper. So who knows? You know, again, I'm free market. If you want to go Bitcoin or an alternative to Bitcoin, I'm all for it. And let me go a step further. A lot of the push of the Morgan Report going forward is for financial technology, fintech as it's referred to. And I'm looking very strongly at alternatives outside the banking system. Bitcoin is one of them. I'm not trying to be a hypocrite here. I think there are alternatives that will manifest that will be bullion backed. So there'll be a physical backing in the electronic form that you could get, let's say, a real Bitcoin, meaning, you know, I know they make them, but what I'm saying is, you know, an equivalent gold or silver position type of thing. So it's a developing technology. It's very interesting. I'm doing my homework on it. I've just ordered two books from Amazon. I have a friend that's very connected there and others in the industry, which you probably know by first name. And so I'm looking at that because I think that any time there is extreme amount of pressure, there will be a relief valve somewhere. And the relief valve is that the free market, sometimes called the black market, will be an alternative. And that's what we're seeing, especially the millennials. I mean, how many millennials do they have bank accounts? So there's the system is ripe for an alternative. I think the only power structure that really gets that is London, which is basically the base of the Anglo-American Empire. If you study it closely enough, and I'll be writing about more of this in the future, is they're actually embracing financial technology. Why? Because they want to continue to control. And if you're moving out of the traditional banking system that you and I, Chris, have known our whole lives, and you move into this, like I'm on my phone and I do a peer-to-peer payment and it's outside of the banking system, they don't want that outside of their control. They want to be in on it. So very interesting times ahead, rapid change. There's what I would call maybe the revolution, you know, meaning there could be a monetary revolution. In fact, I would suggest that maybe too strong a word, but maybe not. I want people to think that there are all these alternatives out there and they're popping up here, there, and everywhere. There'll be winners and losers, but I like the idea that people are saying, you know what? We can create our own system of settlement. We can do it without the banks. We don't need you. And this, of course, is taking place, but on a very low level. But all things start at the beginning, don't they?
You're looking at it from the right angle. You know, supply creates its own demand. Options for the everyday financial transaction could drive a Bitcoin-like alternative, and that's what Bitcoin seems to be doing. It's not putting cash out of business. It's not putting banking out of business. It's just creating its marketplace of its own. NSA, as we all know, thanks to Snowden, has its finger in every transaction online and every conversation online, and you can be sure if they don't, someone above them does. The encryption, I think, is a bit outdated, even though I know everyone thinks it's uncrackable. The NSA and the U.S. government are 20 to 30 years ahead of us with encryption. Factoring prime numbers is no problem for them. I know this is going to be hard for some of our listeners to believe, but factoring enormously large prime numbers, which is what our entire financial security system is based on, is really just a simple process. So if they really want to crack into an account, they can do it. But, you know, again, that's another topic. Let's move back to precious metals. I wanted to ask you about financial instruments such as shares in, let's say, the S&P 500, in Google. Let's take Google, for example, Netflix, Amazon, Tesla. You can buy these shares no matter what the price is. There's always going to be a market. I'd like for our listeners to be reintroduced to the concept that gold and silver, there's a limited supply. There may be a market. There may be a paper market. But once confidence is lost in the ETFs and their ability to perform the contracts, the only thing left are the metals. Maybe silver is suddenly at $100 an ounce, but there's always going to be that proviso if you can find it.
There is a limited amount. There's, you know, the paper paradigm in the gold and silver industry is, you know, roughly 100 to 1. You can make it even 10 to 1. And it goes back to the goldsmiths. I mean, they realized when they were giving out warehouse receipts that about only 10% ever came back and actually exchanged gold. So they started floating worthless paper, but no one knew it because the system worked with a float of 9 to 1 or 10 to 1 roughly. So the whole banking system is based on that premise of fractional reserve. Well, you have fractional reserve banking in the bullion side, and which means that everyone's happy as long as no one really steps up to the window and says, give me gold for this certificate. I own X amount of gold in the XYZ corporation. And because of that, things are just happy to go along the way they are. It also provides a fictional supply because all markets move on supply and demand. So if you can increase the supply by a factor of 10, then what do you think it's going to do to the supply-demand curve? Well, it's going to move it down because there's all this fictional supply out there. So that's a good way to manage the market. When the confidence level, as you said, I'm just repeating back to you really, gets to the critical juncture we talked about earlier in your show, that people say, you know, I don't really trust this anymore. I've got this pretty looking certificate that says I own X amount of gold. I'm taking it over to my bank or over to my broker and I'm going to cash it in. And they say, get in line. We've had a run on the bank. Those are my words, not theirs. They'll use some, you know, obfuscation of, you know, well, there's been a delay and we've been ordered by the Fed to only allocate what's remaining due to the fact that there's a blah, 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 blah. Make it up. They'll make it up. So it's better to be safe than sorry. And, you know, I'm nothing against the ETFs or, you know, any of these paper markets as long as you start with a foundational amount that's safe. In other words, let's just take a real rough example. Let's say you're gray-haired like me and you're, you know, so where would you be? I'd say in that case, you know, and it's individual, you know, maybe you're at 30% physical, 40% physical. So, you know, let's say that all my top tier, mid tier and speculative stocks and the precious metals go to zero. I would be extremely unhappy. but I'd have such a strong physical position and the paper price of it or the value of it would go up so much that I'd be more than well protected. On the other hand, again, the way to beat the bankers is if there's a physical lockup in the metals, which I expect there will be, then these shares will go into the stratosphere. You won't be able to put a price on them because that's the only thing that's remaining. And although they're a piece of paper, if they're the real companies, such as First Majestic, as we talked about, or Avino, for example, these things will have a price that will go crazy because it's the only thing left. And there's a small, small market. People don't realize the word precious and what it really, really means. I mean, if you look at three Olympic-sized swimming pools full of gold, and that's the entire Earth's supply over 5,000 years, and you go out on the moon with your big telescope and you look down on the planet and you compare three Olympic-sized swimming pools to how many Olympic-sized swimming pools exist on the planet, or better yet, how many gas stations exist on the planet. Get a perspective on the commodity oil versus the quote-unquote commodity slash it's now money, gold, and how little gold there is compared to how much oil there is, or how much wheat there is, or any other commodity. So we're in a predicament, and there's no way out. And the bankers know it. And, of course, they're trying to stay ahead of the game, and perhaps they are. But from my perspective, just because they have it planned out, we're going to this and that, we're going to let this one collapse, we're slowly going to let the yen go up against the dollar, and we're going to let China go down again, you know, whatever. I mean, whatever machinations they've come up with to control the situation, the more they try to control it, I would say the more it's going to be out of control. And the problem with most, well, the more you try to control it, I mean, you're balancing an upside down pyramid is what you're doing. I mean, a pyramid is the most stable structure known to man, and the financial system is built on an upside down pyramid, which implies logically it's the most unstable situation you could possibly have. And unless you continue to grow the base, the pyramid's going to topple over, which, you know, it doesn't make sense from what I just said, but the point is that the derivatives market is what's ruling everything. So it's a Ponzi scheme on top of Ponzi scheme on top of bet on top of side bet on top of bet on bet on top of that, and it's all precarious as can be. It's the fall collapse of complex societies. It's the collapse of a complex financial system that nobody understands, and everybody's betting their bottom dollar on the fact that the computers and the electronic world is so powerful that everything's under control.
You talk about three Olympic-sized pools full of gold bullion, and that's essentially the accessible reserves or supply of gold, at least above ground now, circulating in the world and from antiquity until today. Hold on to that image and keep in mind that there's roughly the same amount of gold as there was 30 years ago at the last peak. But now the population of the world has grown by at least double. The amount of wealth, let's just say, has increased. Add in derivatives. Ease of access through eBay and other alternatives, a confluence of events.
Fortunately, it's a reality, and these events happen rarely. This is not something that takes place every year in the financial markets. It's, I don't want to overplay the Shemitah thing, but I've read the book and listened to a couple of Jonathan Kahn's interviews, and I know Jeff Berwick, and I was actually well aware of it probably prior to Berwick, not that it matters, but the point being is that like a jubilee, which is 7/7 or every 50 years, this is something that's possibly a once-in-a-lifetime event. Certainly it's taken place before. I mean, if you look at monetary history, it's the Weimar Republic's one that's most commonly referred to. But if you look at the book, The Silver Manifesto, and you open up to the part of currency failures, you'll see the currency failures between 1981 and 1990, and I don't know what they are, 40 countries. And then the failure between 1991 and 2000, I think it's like 50 or 60 countries. But this is all brushed under the carpet because there's the ability of these countries that have a failed currency like Zimbabwe to use the U.S. dollar. And that's dollars in physical form, what we talked about earlier. So going forward, we do have a synergy of events. We have a distrust in the political system. We have a distrust in the food system with GMOs. We have a distrust in the water supply with fluoridation and what's going on with the, chemical bases. We have a distrust of what's going on in the atmosphere. So basically, we have corruption across the board. We have physical corruption. We've got the Fukushima. We've got the BP oil spill. So we have a confluence of synergistic events that are compounding one on top of the other. So in a mathematical formula type of thing, going back to the, I digress back to the Bitcoin. I just watched The Man Who Saw Infinity, and I got a pretty strong math background. But yes, it can do what you said. So coming back on point, we're going to see a synergistic effect where 1 plus 1 plus 1 doesn't equal 3. 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 30. That's an exponential function. So when the panic starts and when that, you know, third person walks up to the bullion bank and says, here's a cert I've had for 10 years. I've got this much gold. I want the gold physically. And they say, oh, no, you don't. So, oh, yes, I do. I'm standing for delivery. That is when no one can predict exactly when. And that's just an analogy or a metaphor to the what's going to cause it. But what's going to cause it is a shift in psychology. I don't trust even these physical dollars anymore. I can't get them or I don't want them. I rather have the real deal. And there's so little relative to the amount of fiat available in all currencies. And that's why you'll see gold go up against all currencies. Yeah, it's the anti-US dollar for now, because the dollar will be the last man standing. I have little doubt about that. And the alternatives that the BRICS have put in are certainly some protection, but whether or not it's robust enough, if it's anti-fragile enough or not, at this point, I doubt it, but that's my take, that's my opinion, it can't be proven. Only the market will prove true or false on that. So we're in a situation, again, that I want to emphasize, where it's very rare that this will take place, but I have little doubt it will happen in my lifetime.
I just wanted to mention, you brought up The Man Who Saw Infinity or New Infinity, and of course, that's the story of Srinivasa Ramanujan. I have the book here on my desktop. It's free now for anyone who's interested in listening to our voices. I'll send you a copy, and it's just must read. In fact, I would argue that the author has composed one of the finest books, not just on mathematics or any subject. You can't put it down. Even folks who don't care for reading, you won't be able to put this tome down. I have a link to the free story about how G.W. Hardy, one of the world's greatest mathematicians in Oxford at the time, and identified Ramanujan just in the remote nowhere, essentially self-taught. He found a remarkable book by a man who became renowned later, but he just didn't require any proofs at all. What we call today shortcuts in his mathematical endeavors. And this remarkable book is still available. I have a copy I'd like to give to my son, you know, when he's a few years older. And I think it's just a fantastic story. But, you know, the movie, huge fan of Jeremy Irons. What you want is the book here. And I'll bet you've read that. If you don't have a copy, I'll fire one over to you. I'd like to discuss one more topic, and that is the idea that silver has an enormous amount of uses, and it is rarely reclaimed after it's used. Here's an example. Solar power. They have dropped in price. And I remember when solar panels were only for the very wealthy, even the elite. Well, now a family can have a small solar array for just a few $1,000s or less. Each solar panel has roughly 1 ounce, requires a roughly 1 ounce of silver to produce. That a hyperbolic decline in the price of solar panels and the extreme affordability of silver is creating its own demand. Do you want to just run with the ball and give us an idea of whether or not this solar power revolution could bode well for silver investors?
Well, a couple points. First, the recycling industry is actually pretty robust. There is a lot of silver that makes it to the landfill and never gets recycled. Having said that, if you look at the two silver studies, and of course I buy them and study them every year and have since, I don't know what, when I was much younger. The amount of silver recycled is like 170 million ounces a year. So that's a significant amount, especially when you compare it to the amount of silver that was mined on an annual basis up to about 1985, never rose above 350 million ounces. After that, there was a change in the technology to how to mine, and that was a big push into bringing more silver above ground than ever before. Coming back on point, so there is a fair amount of recycling. On the solar situation, I wrote Silver Over the Next Decade, and in that study, one of the main points I looked at was the solar industry. And at the time, it had not an exponential curve, but a very strong linear curve at about a 45-degree angle, and it was projecting solar to use about 140 million ounces of silver on an annual basis relative to about 2016. Remember, this study was done in 2010, so it's projecting out about 6-7 years. That projection was actually accurate for about three or four years. Since then, it's leveled off and actually butt back down. What's interesting, if you did it on a solar panel basis, it would fit that curve almost exactly. The problem is it doesn't fit the curve, and the solar usage, the silver usage in solar went down is because, like anything economic, you squeeze the margins. If you can get X amount of power by using half the amount of silver, you're going to do it. And that's what's taken place. In other words, solar panels have become much more efficient. Silver's not the only component. There's other silicon, and a lot of stuff that goes into one. And the manufacturing process, taking it over to China primarily. So there are a lot of reasons that on a per-panel basis, not only squeeze the amount of silver per panel and increase the efficiency, meaning you still get as much power as per panel as you used to, it's distorted. It hasn't distorted the curve. It is what it is. The market's the market. So where are we now? Well, I'm still bullish on the solar, meaning that India looks like they're going to produce a lot of electricity using solar. So I think you'll see a swing up in the curve. And also, as you said, the demand situation. Yes, I do have some solar here. It's just basically backup as a put up kind of a thing. In other words, some panels that I can just throw up, and I've used it, in fact, and charge a set of gigantic batteries and run my electronics from that. But back on point, so yeah, the more affordable it is, especially in some locations. Now, solar is efficient as burning coal. No, it's not. But it's certainly a lot of people want independence. And in certain areas, solar is the only thing you can have. You can take a mountain cabin out in the middle of nowhere. You're not going to have a power line over there. So I am, neutral as far as efficiency, looking at it from an engineering perspective, but looking at it from an economic perspective, I think we have seen a dip, and I don't think we'll see an upswing in solar demand, but I don't think it will be as robust as Jessica Cross indicated when she put out her report in 2010, which is what I referred to in mine, citing her work in that area. Of course, I added my own thoughts, but nonetheless, an important and significant part, which leads us all the way back to the beginning of the interview, which means, why are these electronic companies going to major silver producers and saying, give me direct, I don't want a middleman? And the reason is that it's not just solar, it's electronic gadgets. As I've said in the past, silver is the best technology stock you can buy. Hey, it's a physical element. So there's a lot going on across the board. And one that we never talk about is what is the military use of the silver supply? And no one really knows the exact amount, but a lot of mil-spec electronics are driven by silver. You think that their solar panels aren't the top-notch solar panels? What do you think about their battery life? You think they're using lithium everywhere? Yeah, they use a lot of lithium. But when it hits a mil-spec and it's got to be out there for days and days, guess what? They're using silver-based batteries. So there's a lot that goes on that really isn't known. There are some enigmas in the silver market. I certainly never claim to know it all. Certainly, I continue to research and learn more. But there's no one on the planet that has every detail about any commodity, let alone the silver market.
I have a slightly different view on the exponential growth of solar panels, and there's a couple of reasons why. Firstly, gold and silver, the best conductors. Of course, gold, slightly better electronic conductor, but silver, of course, is much more cost-effective at, let's say, 70 times less per ounce. It's viewed as insignificant in the process right now. That's going to change. I'm sure you'd agree. There is, from what I've read, absolutely no alternative. Copper cannot take the place of silver in extremely sensitive electronics, and that's what we really have today, advanced electronics. And I'd also add that we're looking for, according to several recent studies, exponential growth in the demand for solar power. There are some indications that the entire coal business around the world, even in China, and of course the United States is the Saudi Arabia, as you know, of coal, a complete shutdown of all coal production. Firstly, because of environmental reasons. Secondly, because of the rise, the exponential increase in affordability of solar power. So the combination, another confluence of events, could send silver almost to parity with gold.
Well, I think it'll be a good year, not a great year. I want to offer everybody a free report. It's on themorganreport.com. All we need is a first name and an email address. And it's a 12-page report that I wrote myself. You'll get access to a movie about the Age of Empire and the collapse and where we are, with some solutions at the end of the movie, which are definitely worth considering. A lot of other information. If you go to, if you use Twitter at all, look for hashtag silver affiliate. I've got some information there. So you, if you're a silver or a gold stacker, you can actually get paid while you stack. And then the video, excuse me, the Twitter feed is at SilverGuru22 and the YouTube channel is SilverGuru.
We appreciate your comments here on the markets and look forward to more of those in 2016.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. I rarely watch television live as it happens, and prefer instead to watch events that have been recorded, so I can zoom through them to speed up my productivity by not wasting a lot of time watching things that do not interest me. Today I made an exception and watched the inauguration of President-elect Trump, as he was sworn into office and became President Trump, the 45th President of the United States of America. There will be much discussion on the implementation of his vision in the days, weeks, and months ahead. As a business and motivational speaker most of my adult life, I have heard over 1,000 CEOs deliver speeches to their organizations that the general public has never heard. I've seen the best of the best, and I must say President Trump's inauguration speech represented the best of the best for a variety of reasons. But one in particular, he made the essence of his speech not about himself, not about some lofty political or feel-good philosophical perspective. No, he made this speech about his audience, about those he serves, about implementing a vision that will empower the individual. He defined clear objectives that were easy to understand and allowed his audience to visualize and realistically expect that his actions would ultimately benefit each person. He said, "Everyone is listening to you now." He said, "We are transferring power from Washington, D.C. and giving it back to you, the American people." He said, "For too many of our citizens, a different reality exists. That different reality, from an economic perspective, is one that has been discussed here on GoldSeek.com Radio for the past 8 years. He said, "The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer." He appealed to everyone's rational self-interest, what some have called radio station WIIFM. What's in it for me? And without saying so directly, he left the strong impression that everyone who wanted to would be able to prosper under his administration. And at the end of the day, deep down, that's what everyone wants. He acknowledged that nations the world over should put their own interests first, just as he intends to do for the U.S., and by implication, that everyone should compete and collaborate, and that the U.S. will lead by example in this process under his leadership. From a CEO perspective, President Trump's inauguration speech contained all the elements required to empower the people in his organization, which is now the United States of America, to do great things. He said, "When America is united, America is totally unstoppable. Whether it's strength, safety, wealth, or feeling proud, each person will be able to hold him accountable for how his plan impacts them and their families. I'm dating myself a bit, but for those who remember, when Ross Perot ran for president in 1992, this was the kind of speech I was expecting to hear had he won. But he didn't win in 1992. He quit and then re-entered. It's been 24 long years. And this time, the only quitters were all the other candidates. Trump stayed on message. And he is now our president. After 24 long years, it's time to get to work. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.